I'm Dr. Brian Goldman, host of the CBC podcast, The Dose. Each week, we answer vital health questions that will help you thrive, like, what does my mental health have to do with my gut? How can I prevent melanoma? How much sleep do I really need? And how can I manage my health without a family doctor? I chat with the top experts to bring you the latest evidence in plain language, all in about 20 minutes. Find The Dose on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This is Spark. Tell me, how's your work life treating you these days? If you're back in a workplace all or part of the time, you may be wondering how to maximize the benefits of being in person. If you're fully remote, maybe you're questioning how to build relationships with people and bosses you never see in the flesh. And if you've been in person all along, how can you kickstart collaboration at work for better job satisfaction? This time, a designer, an environmental psychologist, and an AI expert help us get better at workplace collaboration, understanding why it matters and where it's going. To start off this episode, if we could wave a magic wand and design an ideal collaborative workspace from the ground up, what would it look like? You'd want a place where people can, you know, meet and talk about stuff, and a place where they can work together on a shared project. But you'd also want a place where you could have some quiet time for solo work. We know all this, right? But why is it that some spaces just feel right for collaboration, comfortable, inviting trust? For that, we need an environmental psychologist. A what?
We're the people in the scientific world who think about how the world around you, you know, what you're seeing, smelling, how close other people are to you, how all that influences how you think and behave. And so this work is grounded in neuroscience, because what's going on in our brain is affected by, you know, where we are in the world.
This is Sally Augustine. She's an environmental psychologist. Part of Sally's work is consulting with organizations on how to design spaces for things like performance or well-being.
When you're designing a workspace, there are a number of different factors that have to be considered. But the single most important factor is what the users do that adds value to the organization, because you have to be sure, you have to be positive that the space developed will allow people to not only perform to their full potential, but ensure that their organization is successful.
I see. So it's not the same for all workplaces, depending on the type of work being done, for example.
I mean, you know, obviously there are some, you know, generalizations from one place to another. You know, like we can all be distracted by hearing people speak around us. But for some jobs, that can actually be a plus because it can help people keep track of, you know, what's going on around them. So even though they're a little distracted, keeps them tuned in. They can perform to a higher level at their assigned tasks, activities, etc. So, you know, you always have to think about what success is in a particular situation and act accordingly.
Mm-hmm. So what are you seeing in your practice as more organizations have either gone back to in-person full-time or are doing hybrid? Like, are there different ways that employers are thinking about physical workspaces now in terms of just maximizing the value of people being, you know, physically together?
People are thinking about the physical workplace more just in general. You know, it's been brought top of mind by all these debates about whether people should actually be in the space, you know, how they perform in the space versus how they perform at their homes, et cetera. So organizations that previously just sort of let the physical workplace happen, it was whatever it was, maybe there was some consideration of like ergonomics, but now everybody is thinking about the physical work environment and how it can support the people that they pay.
Mm-hmm. So we're looking at collaboration on this week's show. What kind of design choices help make a physical workspace good for collaborating?
When you're thinking about designing for collaboration, you need to be considering factors that allow everybody to participate actively. You know, so there are some things about designing for collaboration that won't surprise you at all. For example, if you remember in kindergarten when the teacher used to arrange all the desks in a circle so everybody could see each other's face, well, that does help with collaboration. But, you know, there are some factors that, you know, didn't come up in kindergarten that need to be considered. Things like everybody, every group needs an eye contact break from time to time. If we, you know, we've all had the experience in Zoom where people just like stare at the camera for forever. So it's like top of mind how like weird that is when people don't make eye contact. But, you know, it can be a little awkward to break eye contact with other people. So you need to give people something that they can gracefully divert their gaze to from time to time in order to break eye contact without making people upset. So, you know, that could be, you know, something really cool like a fish tank or whatever, or it could just be like a window that people might look over at gracefully every so often. So, you know, you have to think about eye contact breaks, you know, particularly when you're dealing with people from different cultures, because, you know, those of us from the West, you know, we're into making eye contact with people. You know, like we were taught in that same kindergarten class that making eye contact with people shows you're paying attention, you know, care about what they have to say, but that can really be too much for some cultures. You know, you also need to think about things that might not be so obvious, such as when you're designing a place for people to collaborate, everybody should be sitting in chairs whose legs are the same length, because if people are on like much higher seats or much lower seats, well, it turns out that, you know, surprise, surprise, people who are being physically looked up to because their seat is higher, well, we feel they're more competent, more capable. We actually associate all sorts of attributes to them that we do to adults, right? People who are literally physically being looked down on seem more childlike. Mm. What they have to say doesn't seem as maybe as relevant. You know, they don't seem as competent, etc. And this kind of thing really throws off the dynamic.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're thinking about arranging the furniture beyond the circle, say there's just a couple people engaged in a conversation, it's best if their chairs are at right angles to each other. That works out really well because, you know, people can gracefully look at each other, look away, you know, calmly, you know, they can split their attention in ways that seem natural and actually allow very tough topics to be discussed. If you're talking with somebody whose performance might not be quite up to snuff, for example, this right angle thing can work out well for everybody. And then, you know, there's other things that come into play, like scents, soundscapes, etc.
Mm-hmm. What about design choices that affect mood? For instance, something that makes you feel more trusting or more open, which in itself can be important for collaborating.
Sure. It turns out when we smell lavender, we are more apt to trust those who are around us, which can be a big plus. We'll be in a much better mood in terms of collaborating with others if we're in a space where colors are not very saturated, but relatively light, like a sage green with lots and lots of white mixed into it. They put us in a mood that's relaxed and calm, but you know, your goal here is not to relax and calm people to the point where they go to sleep. That doesn't do anybody any good in terms of a workplace. You're trying to create a situation where people feel calm and confident.
Yeah. And so then how do you build spaces that support collaboration, but then also make it possible for people to do solitary work when they need to?
Well, that all gets into zoning, and really. And you have to be realistic about how noise carries and things like that. Every so often I find somebody who will build a space for collaboration and they'll put spaces for solo work like right beside it. You know, it's like, no, people. Like, do you not have ears? have you ever been in a workplace? You know, distance is generally your friend here. So, you know, spaces for collaboration, it's great when they have walls, doors. Sometimes that's possible. Sometimes it's not for various reasons. If it's not, then you want things like hallways and circulation paths between the collaboration zones and the spaces where people are doing thoughtful work. And you can move even beyond the distance by doing things like being careful how you orient the seats that people will be in when they're doing thoughtful work, ideally, so that they can't see a bunch of activity around them, because if we see people walking around and all that, we're into it. We got to pay attention to it.
Yeah.
So the most significant way to a workplace can support both collaboration and individual work is by zoning these activities, and also by giving people permission to move from one space to another as they need it.
Mm-hmm. Are there different things that you have to think about when people are collaborating on making actual physical things? Like, for example, in a restaurant kitchen or a manufacturing facility, that the different things you have to consider?
Yeah, you know, obviously beyond the tools, you know, that would have to be in place, it's particularly important to think about how distorted one activity can be by view of others. So say a manufacturing facility, if people can see other people doing a certain sort of activity, they're more likely, again, just because of how humans think and behave, they're likely to try to begin to engage in the same activity, which may or may not be appropriate. But if their view is slightly different and they don't oversee those other people working, then they're more likely to follow a different activity. So views that are particularly important in these contexts.
Yeah. And can that be of benefit? For example, you know, a lot of what we do when we collaborate is we learn from each other. We learn by example. So if we have people near us who are doing the same physical activity, can that be an opportunity to actually just sort of learn, because I can see, oh, Sally's using the wrench this way or whatever.
Yeah, no, I mean, it can be, as you point out, tremendously useful to observe people in the same group that you're in, even if you're not working with hammers or wrenches or anything like that. Just in general, you know, if you can spend time around others doing the same sort of job, even if it's classic office work, you get an idea of how different sorts of tools might be used that might be online, etc., just because you can't help but see people's screens and you can't help but overhear telephone conversations. So, you know, when you're doing more routine type tasks, it can be really great to be able to see other people.
Those who dream and design are always contributing to our ways of work. Working situations benefit from a new kind of layout, bright, open, and inviting. The modern designer creates beauty through simplicity, bringing to active business a look of casualness, a look of luxury.
I'm Nora Young, and today we're talking about how workplace design, whether it's an office, a restaurant, or a shop floor, can be optimized for better collaboration. Right now, my guest is Sally Augustine. She's an environmental psychologist who uses insights from neuroscience to design spaces that support well-being, performance, and creativity. You recently co-authored a paper on real-world spaces for creative thinking. Can you tell me a bit about your findings?
Creative thinking is a real challenge, you know, because it requires taking information, integrating it in new and different ways to achieve a particular end. And the people in my world have thoroughly researched the conditions in which people are more likely to think creatively. For example, seeing different shades of green, particularly those that aren't very saturated and are relatively light, like that sage green I was mentioning before with lots of white into it. Well, looking at those sorts of greens, you know, on surfaces, etc., is likely to enhance our creative performance. So is seeing plants, being in natural light, light that's a little warmer than usual can help. Being in a space that has relatively more curving lines than straight lines. And you can think about curving lines and the straight line thing in two dimensions or three dimensions. You know, it could be like two dimensions, like patterns in carpets or in upholstery, whatever. You know, go for like the more organic shapes as opposed to more geometric type patterns with the squares and the triangles and all that are clearly defined. They're great when you want people to be doing something efficient, active, like walking down a hall. That'll keep people moving along because it brings thoughts of efficiency and action to mind. But when you're trying to encourage people to think creatively, go for table shapes, the backs of sofas and things like that. Other things you can think of, naturescapes, like soundscapes, like hearing water type sounds, gently calling birds, rustling wind, that can help with creative thinking. Some enterprising researchers a while ago learned that if we smell cinnamon vanilla, which happens to be exactly the smell of those Cinnabon muffins that are in airports everywhere, smelling that smell has been linked to enhanced creative performance. You know, so when you're trudging through the airport next time and you smell that smell and you start to think, I would really like that. Wow, you can justify that Cinnabon. Isn't that nice? You know, like, but there's other things that come into play also. Like, as it turns out, we think more creatively when we're walking along or just after we've been for a walk. So, you know, if you're designing a workplace, you can create places where people can walk inside or outside. So we can think about sensory experiences and actually being in motion, having control of our environment, lots of similar things that all enhance creative performance.
And so this is creativity, not just in the sense of artistic creativity, but also in the sense of just creative thought and problem solving and that kind of thing.
Yes.
And why does that work? Does it come down to the fact that we are all animals and there's something about organic curving spaces that puts us in an open frame? Or
it actually does all seem to come back to our early days as a species and what made us very comfortable then, what ensured our survival then, because when we're very comfortable, we actually, you know, when we feel secure, safe, etc., we can free up parts of our mind to be engaged in creative thought. You know, we're not worried if that shadow is a tiger or something like that. So, you know, it does seem that we can trace these things that support our creativity back to what made us feel comfortable and secure when, you know, we were just starting out eons and eons ago.
Mm-hmm. Sally, thanks so much for your insights on this.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Sally Augustine is an environmental design psychologist and the principal at consulting firm Design with Science.
I'd like to open this meeting by pointing out that the workers can't prosper unless the company prospers. That means we have to work together, cooperate.
Anything the matter?
No, nothing. I just wanted to tell you that I never thought it would work, but it does.
Good.
We are settling our differences, and production has increased.
Sure. And we make suggestions that are good for both of us.
That's right.
Yes, both sides gain.
That's the way it goes, Dick. We give a little, we take a little, we compromise and we cooperate.
Exactly. There's no doubt about it. We're both profiting by working together. Right, John?
Right.
You're listening to Spark from your friends at CBC Radio.
I'm Dr. Brian Goldman, host of the CBC podcast, The Dose. Each week, we answer health topics in a smart and sometimes counterintuitive way you won't hear anywhere else. Like, what's the least amount of exercise I can do to get the benefits? Which psychedelics can improve my mental health? And how can I check for cancer if I don't have a family doctor? Top experts help me bring you what you need to know in plain language in about 20 minutes. Find The Dose on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Nora Young and this is Spark. This time we've got a how-to guide on getting better at collaborating in the workplace and how it can lead to greater satisfaction and better performance on the job. We've just heard about how the physical layout of a place can be designed to maximize creative thinking and collaboration. And that's great if you're self-employed or otherwise run a business. But let's face it, most of us don't have much, if any, control over our physical workspace. And that can be frustrating. So how can we look at the parts of our jobs we do have some control over? Things that'll make work more satisfying, like finding opportunities to work better with others, building relationships, and communicating. How about we learn from what people in highly collaborative jobs already do?
My name is Bill Burnett. I'm the executive director of the Life Design Lab at Stanford and an adjunct professor in the School of Engineering.
Bill's worked as a designer at companies like Apple and in the toy industry. He's also the co-author of Designing Your New Work Life, How to Thrive and Change and Find Happiness and a New Freedom at Work, which he wrote with entrepreneur and colleague Dave Evans. It's a guide to improving your work life bit by bit using a designer's toolkit and mindset. So, what can design teach us about working together?
The big thing is radical collaboration, because we know that if we collide people with lots of different backgrounds together on a design team, we're just going to have a much richer set of possible solutions. You know, a typical design team nowadays, you know, if I were a designer at IDEO, that team might have a couple people trained in design, trained in the idea of empathy and building prototypes and things. But it might also have a neuroscientist, because we really want to understand how people think. It might have an economist, because we're trying to figure out what's the value of what we're doing, maybe in market terms. And then it might also have, you know, a few behavioral psychologists or an anthropologist, because these are the kinds of people who are going to bring really new and different sort of mindsets to the problem. And that's going to give us the best possible chance for a radically new solution.
Right. And is it as an individual thinking this way, are you looking kind of both inside and outside of an organization?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I was at Apple way back in the 90s when we did the first laptop. And so we studied how people were working. We studied people on airplanes trying to get stuff done. We studied all sorts of folks. And we used the same tools to figure out what would the configuration of, you know, a portable computer or something be. And we built lots and lots and lots of prototypes. And the process is very human, so it's really iterative. You go around and around and around. Nobody knew what a laptop would be like in those days. I wasn't on the iPhone team, but nobody knew what an iPhone was before they started. You know, a lot of times when you're in design, someone has a specification. They say, hey, let's design the new coffee cup. And we want a 16-ounce instead of a 12-ounce. And so, you know, there's not a lot of research necessary. You just kind of go make new coffee cups. But when you're making something that can't be specified, nobody knows what it is, you need this collaboration with lots of people to understand what the needs are. And then you just make lots and lots of guesses, prototypes, we call them, until you sort of figure something out that seems to work. Mm. My rule is when you give some users a prototype and they won't give it back, then you know you're on the right track.
Right.
And it's the same thing with life design. You know, then the empathy is from me. What do I want? What's my life view? What's my work view? What am I thinking, you know, is important to me in this big, giant process called life with a job in it? And I'm also having empathy for the world. Just because I want to do something doesn't mean the world cares, right? Mm-hmm. I need to be out in the world collaborating with people to understand what the world needs from me. And when those two things match, you know, you have a pretty good situation, pretty good job.
Yeah. Your most recent book, Designing Your New Work Life, is about using design thinking to improve your work life.
Yep.
So how can I get better at collaborating with others at work, learning with others, helping others, asking for help, that kind of thing?
People are intrinsically motivated. People are unusual in that they'll do things just because they want to get better at something, because they like working with people, because they need a sense of agency or autonomy in their life. And technically, they called it autonomy, relatedness, and competence. So we said, well, you know, ARC, the arc of your career. Relatedness is the key thing to lean into here. I mean, we're human animals and we're tribal. We like to be in relatedness with other people, in relationship with others. So it's an intrinsic motivation to get to know your coworkers, to get to know your suppliers, folks you work with, whatever, vendors and stuff. And some people are people and they like to meet everybody, and that's great. And other people, you know, I'm more of the introvert on the team. Dave's the extrovert. But in any case, we know that you can improve the way you experience work by improving your relationships. And you do that in a very specific sort of way. If you want to take a designer's approach, we have this thing we call the Good Work Journal, where you kind of note every day something that went well. Who did you help? You know, what did you learn? And maybe, what did you initiate? So initiation is autonomy. Learning is competence. Who did you help is relatedness, right? So, hey, I helped Gladys fix a jam on the copier. Make a little note. Hey, I learned how to do, you know, the pivot tables on Excel for the first time. I've never learned how to do that. So it's really simple, small things, little tiny things that you notice that you do every day. And then you just try to up your game.
Right. So there's an intrinsic benefit to doing it. And not to say what's in it for me, but what's in it for me. I mean, beyond the intrinsic benefit, can a collaborative approach reap sort of more, I don't want to call them objective benefits, but do you know what I mean? Can that improve my work life in other tangible ways?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, an employee who comes to work and initiates things is going to get a much higher review from their supervisor or their boss. An employee who comes to work who's taking responsibility for their point of view or their attitude is going to get a much warmer response from their coworkers. Now, look, I mean, and we're really clear. You got a toxic workspace. People are being discriminatory. People are, you know, harassing you or something. Get the heck out if you can. Don't tolerate bad workplaces. But most people have lots more agency than they think they have. And the small things that bother them can be fixed.
Yeah. Can we talk a bit about brainstorming, especially brainstorming with other people? Because I think that's something that designers do really well,
oh, yeah.
And we know there's a value to it, but it seems to provoke anxiety in a lot of people as well. So how do we do brainstorming with others well?
This is a really big topic. I'm glad you brought it up because I love brainstorming and I love teaching people to do it well. And when they do it well, they get into this almost state of flow where, you know, ideas are just coming and they really feel connected to the people they're brainstorming with. But I find that a lot of people think they know how to brainstorm and they don't. So the first part of a brainstorm is you got to have a good question. You know, if you frame a good question that's what we call generative, that can generate lots of possible solutions, then you're going to get a good start. I mean, but if your question is a binary, it's like, should we do this or this? That's not brainstormable. That's just, well, I don't, you know, let's do the pro-con yeah. list on these two things and see what happens.
Right.
But if I, you know, how might, and we often use the sentence stem, how might we, you know, come up with a lot of new ways to improve our customer service in this one area or whatever it is? And then you say, great. The other thing is when people are coming from the budget meeting or they just had a review with their boss or they just did, you know, some analysis of some data with a spreadsheet, they're in their rational thinking mind. They're not in their brainstorming mind. And you really do need to warm up, just like an athlete, just like anybody. You got to get in the right mindset. So we always run little warm-up exercises, little improvs, things that we steal from the improv comedy folks, or just ways of getting people to kind of, okay, relax. We're not doing spreadsheets. We're doing something really different. Let's play a little game. My favorite is yes and.
What's yes and?
Comes from the improv comedy guy. I say, hey, we're going to plan a birthday party for my wife and I'm going to have a cake. And the only thing you're allowed to say is yes and add an idea. And we just keep doing it until it gets absurd.
Right.
And then we do the brainstorm. And the trick with the brainstorm, my metaphor is, imagine you were a jazz ensemble, okay? So when Miles Davis gets the quintet together, the idea is we're going to play a song, kind of blue, but we're going to play it the way we've never played it before. Now, we all know the song and we know the rough, you know, the chord changes in the melody. But when it's your turn to solo, you're going to take 16 bars and do something amazing. And I don't even know what I'm going to do until I hear what you do. And as soon as you're done, it's my turn and then I solo. And when you're soloing, my job is to make you sound great. Keep the beat, keep the rhythm, keep everything going. And when you pass it to me, then I do my thing and we pass it around. Miles does his thing, blah, blah. Two things. You never stop the song. You just keep playing. And we're improvising in the moment. So I don't actually know what I'm going to do until I hear what you do.
Right.
And
right.
you're going to take 16 bars, but you were really on a roll. So you took another, you know, eight. I'm like, oh, wow. She did something amazing. Then I do something. Then you do something. Then I do something. And it's that creating in the moment, which is that flow state. And it takes practice. I mean, if I just said, all right, now let's really do jazz. I hand you a saxophone and said, let's play jazz. And you're like, I don't know how to do this.
Yes, which I don't.
Well,
yes.
Our instrument is our brain. And it takes practice to get into that zone. It takes practice to get into that, you know, non-associative, rapidly linear, massively parallel processing. And when four or five people who are really good at this get together, it's amazing. And then all the post-its on the wall, and then somebody says, oh, I'll take a picture on my phone. I have a theory that cell phones are where ideas go to die. Nothing ever happens with that picture, right? You have to do something with the picture. You have to take the ideas and sort them into categories and try to make them into some kind of actionable prototype. And people say, well, creativity can't be measured. Look, if there was three of us in a brainstorm and we were going to brainstorm for 10 minutes, if we only each had one idea a minute, which is pretty easy, one idea a minute times three, that's three ideas a minute times 10, that's 30 ideas. That'd be okay. And when I do a novice brainstorming group, they'll have 20 to 30 ideas roughly, and because they're okay, but they're not really clicking. Okay, I get my best designers. I get my senior designers. We were having, on average, five ideas a minute each, one every 20 seconds. So when you know how to do this, the level of performance is 10x. But it takes practice, just like learning how to play jazz.
Yeah, good point. I'm Nora Young, and this time on Spark, we're looking at how to get better at collaborating in the workplace. Right now, I'm talking to designer Bill Burnett, co-author of Designing Your New Work Life, about what we can learn from design thinking. For people who worked remotely during the pandemic, there were a lot of barriers to communication, the limits of video conferencing being just one. So what do we need to think about in improving communication, whether we're in person or remote?
Yeah, well, you know, this is, I think, where the whole designer mindset of empathy comes in. I mean, communication is a two-way street. This is a lesson I learn every day in my relationship with my wife. We'll be married 36 years next week. If you're simultaneously thinking of your answer while you're listening to the other person's, you know, point of view, you're not listening. This is the classic, you know, Bill thing or guy thing, I'll say, is like, you know, my wife is saying something and I'm already thinking what I want to tell her, you know, my cool thing to add to her thing, and she hasn't finished yet. We need to all slow down and listen to the other person. It's harder when it's remote like this on Zoom because we don't see all the other nonverbal clues and things, but people can do it. And what we did to substitute when we were online and couldn't be in person is we used digital whiteboards, and I could move a post-it around and you could move a post-it around, and it felt a little more like we were connected. But I really do think it's just empathy and learning to listen very, very well. After the brainstorm, we're doing a synthesis activity. We're trying to synthesize the ideas down. And I'm saying, well, I think this idea and this idea, if we put them together, might mean this. And what you'll often hear designers say, just to make sure we're clear, because, you know, in the early part of synthesis, it's all still pretty fuzzy. I'm not sure I really like this idea or that idea. I'm not sure. You'll hear people say, hey, Nora, what I heard you say was, if we combine A and B, we'll get Z, which is really different than D. Do I have that right? So we're always kind of checking in to make sure, you know, as we navigate through a fuzzy conversation, that we're really understanding each other, including each other's ambiguity. I'm not sure I really think this is a good idea, but, right? So, you know, I think designers are really good at that because they have to, one, listen in the interviewing they're doing when they're doing the first parts of empathy. And two, when you're having new ideas, they're pretty fragile. I would say they're like little babies. You got to take care of them. They got to grow up a little before you judge them. And so many people just want to shoot down ideas. It feels so good to feel smart. You know, I'm going to tell you that won't work, Nora, and I'm going to tell you why it won't work. And you know, we tried that before. And da, 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 da. So, yeah, empathy, communication, checking in, making sure that you mirror back to people what I think I heard you say, Nora, was, did I get that right? Those are all just good techniques.
And just finally, Bill, these are obviously uncharted times in a lot of ways, from the growth of AI in the workplace to the future of remote and hybrid work. Do you have any sort of tips or thoughts for people trying to navigate uncertainty at work, especially as it touches on collaborative relationships?
Before the pandemic, remote work is like 2 or 3%, and now it's 30 or 40%. And almost every company I've talked to that knows what it's talking about has come back with a sort of a hybrid 3-2 or a 4-1 or something like that. And it hasn't actually impacted collaboration at work very much at all. But it has made it clear that collaboration has to be intentional. So if we get together to brainstorm, whether we do it in person or online, let's do it really well. Let's do it effectively. If we have a problem at work with communication, you know, the engineering team isn't talking to the marketing team. The marketing team is not talking to the finance team, whatever it is. It becomes really obvious. and the consequences of it become obvious. And so now we need to be more intentional about fixing those things, because nobody wants to be in an environment where there's bad communication or there's miscommunication. And 90% of this is just people weren't paying attention, and they weren't doing it very well. They weren't quite very artful at communication. 10% of it is some people are lying, some people are gaming the system, some people are playing politics. So, you know, separating that out, that's a different problem. That's a management problem.
Yeah. Bill, thanks so much for your insights on this.
You're welcome. It was fun talking with you.
Bill Burnett is an adjunct professor and the executive director of the Life Design Lab at Stanford and the co-author of Designing Your New Work Life. I'm Nora Young, and this time on Spark, we're talking about collaboration. So far, we've looked at how changes in the physical workspace make it easier to collaborate and do quiet, focused work. And as Bill Burnett just said, collaborating with other people takes skill and practice, practices that workplaces need to support. For the rest of the show, we're going to switch gears a bit and talk about why and how collaboration is being used in artificial intelligence. Researchers are learning from the way humans interact with each other to get better at teaching machine learning. What does that mean for the future of the workplace when maybe you're collaborating not just with human coworkers, but with AI and robots?
Hello, colleague, Nora Young. Have you watched the Succession finale yet, or what?
Turns out that's already happening.
My name is Brian Christian. I'm a researcher and a nonfiction author, most recently of a book called The Alignment Problem, Machine Learning and Human Values.
The alignment problem is basically how to get AI systems to align with our values, how to get them to do what we want and expect.
I think it's in some ways the problem.
Machine learning involves training AI systems on datasets, an approach that's powered the giant leaps in artificial intelligence in the past decade. But
if you talk to any AI researcher, they all have their own set of personal horror stories of setting up some objective function that they thought was good enough to get the system to do what they had in mind. And of course, it was not. The system has a funny way of giving you what you asked for, but not what you wanted.
That means producing outcomes that aren't only unintended, but objectionable.
And as these systems get more powerful, that problem is going to become, you know, potentially much more serious.
Brian's written about training AI systems not so much to achieve their objectives, but to help us achieve our objectives, how to cooperate with us.
I think we're really moving into a new phase in the field of machine learning, where we are treating the objective function itself as a machine learning problem that the computer has to infer. So rather than us specifying this mathematical formulation of what we want the system to do, we can merely give some examples of the behavior that we have in mind and then push this onto the system itself to figure out how to express what it thinks we want in a language that it can understand, namely, you know, mathematics. For me, the canonical example of this, or the foundational example of this, was a study that was done between OpenAI and DeepMind on whether they could get a robot to do a backflip. Mm-hmm. And I love this example because a backflip is the kind of thing that is very hard to specify with a mathematical formula. It's not clear at all how you would do that, but it's very easy to identify if you see one, right? You know it when you see it. Mm-hmm. And so they devised this procedure where they're simulated robot would just wriggle around on the ground, basically at random, and it would show you two video clips and say, which of these looks infinitesimally more like whatever you have in mind? Uh-huh. And you think, okay, well, I guess that's sort of wriggling in the clockwise direction, so sure, okay. And it would go off and try to do a better job now that it has this tiny bit of information of, okay, you preferred A to B. And it turns out that after about an hour of this, which sounds a little bit tedious, but it's only, you know, a couple hundred comparisons, the system is able to do these beautiful gymnastic-looking backflips and stick the landing. Hmm. To me, that is a very, very big deal, because this is a proof of concept that we have the ability to convey these more sort of ineffable human concepts, in this case, a kind of aesthetic concept of what a backflip entails, and we can get that concept out of our heads and into the machine without ever having to go through that step of manually turning it into a mathematical function.
So in some ways, we're like teaching these systems to infer what we want, essentially, right?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
As with that example, the backflip, does it typically rely on a human sort of collaborating with the thing and kind of saying, yeah, that's sort of a bit more like what I want you to do? Is that how it usually works?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it's a very close collaboration. And in fact, one of the things that the research team behind this discovered early on is that it really does require an ongoing process of feedback. So if you give a bunch of data points at the very beginning and then you tell the system to just kind of go off on its own and figure it out, you're not going to get a successful result. What you need is to do this kind of iterative feedback process where you give a little bit of feedback and then the system optimizes a little bit and then comes back to you and says, okay, now what do you think? And you give a little bit more feedback. And through that process, that more sort of, you know, interactive dialogue looking process, mm-hmm. that's how you end up getting there. And so I think that's a very telling statement just about the sort of relationship that we're going to expect to have with these systems going forward.
Yeah. And how analogous is that type of process to the way, or to what we know about the way humans learn from other humans to do things, or children learn from their parents how to do things?
From a cognitive science psychology perspective, this ability to infer the goals of other people based on their behavior is absolutely foundational to human cognition. So there's been some really amazing work in developmental psychology by people like Felix Varnekin, looking at how children, even as young as 18 months, can observe an adult who's reaching for an object that's out of reach. The children will realize that the adult needs help and will spontaneously, you know, jump in to pick up the object and hand it to the adult. Or they'll see an adult carrying a stack of heavy books and trying to put them away in a cabinet, but the cabinet door is closed. The child immediately understands the situation, what the adult wants, what the obstacle is, realizes that they can help, and then will spontaneously walk up and open the door for the adult. And so I think that's very remarkable because it shows both that this ability to infer the goals and desires of other people is very hardwired. I mean, this is very early on in child development. It's arguably unique to humans. Mm-hmm. And also the desire to help seems very hardwired and potentially unique to humans as well. And so there's a lot still to be worked out in terms of where this capability comes from, how we're able to make this leap of understanding what people want just by observing what they're doing. But it is fascinating to me that we are now essentially replicating this capacity and this drive to help in the machines that we're building.
Yeah. And I mean, as humans, we sort of tacitly communicate our intentions to other people, right? Like if you and I are making a meal together, I communicate a lot just with my body language. I don't necessarily say, oh, Brian, can you move out of the way because I'm going to use the stove now?
You sort
of observe that I'm moving towards a stove with a frying pan in my hand, and you naturally accommodate your movements, right? I mean, humans are very subtle at our ability to do this.
That's absolutely right. And this is something that people in the robotics community are very interested in, is if you and I are having dinner and I'm reaching for the salt shaker, I'm probably not going to reach for it in the most ergonomically efficient way, but rather in the most kind of communicative way. So I might exaggerate the angle that I'm reaching for in a way that's like quite inefficient, but that indicates to you more precisely which object I'm attempting to reach for. And so this is one of the things that is interesting to people in the robotics community in both directions. You know, on the one hand, how can these robotic systems understand the intention of a human that they're sharing physical space with and, you know, get out of the way or hand them the object? On the other hand, how can the robot itself move in a way that is expressive and communicative to human users so that we can understand its intentions and get out of its way, for example?
So is there actually active work being done to research this? Like how, you know, if a robot and a human are working on a physical object together, how those kinds of things can be taught, how that communication can be facilitated?
Yeah, this is absolutely an active area for academic roboticists at places like Berkeley, University of Washington, MIT. And in particular, this is of interest in a manufacturing setting. There's a real paradigm shift that's occurring right now in industrial manufacturing. So we're used to thinking of an assembly line that's moving at a kind of automatic pace, and there's kind of a robot section of the assembly line with these giant, dangerous automatic systems pretty much just moving automatically, not really perceiving or sensing the environment. Mm-hmm. And then separated by a bunch of, you know, cages or whatever is the human section where the humans are working. And this is sometimes known as monument style manufacturing, where there's this kind of giant robot area off on its own. That is, I think, increasingly coming to be out of date. I think we're very much moving toward a system where what manufacturers have in mind is a much more kind of elbow-to-elbow collaboration. Robots and humans fluidly moving in the same environment, working on something together, working on two different parts of the same object at the same time, or handing tools, you know, or pieces of the thing being constructed back and forth. And that sort of thing really requires a completely different approach. And it requires that kind of gestural communication that humans, you know, as we've been describing, find so kind of natural and effortless. Well, suddenly we have to figure out what is going on under the hood when people move in a certain way. How do they expect that to be interpreted? Because we now expect our robots to understand what we're trying to do in the same way.
And do you think we're going to get to that point where we can work alongside robots in a way where we don't risk getting, you know, crushed if it gets it wrong?
Right. We're certainly going in that direction. I'm thinking about the MIT roboticist Julie Shaw, for example, who has done some work with Boeing. And we are starting to see airplane manufacturing moving in this direction, where there's a little bit more of a kind of swirling beehive of activity where humans and robots are just kind of moving around, working on the same object at the same time. You know, it's early days, but it does seem that this is the direction that certainly aerospace manufacturing is moving in.
I'm Nora Young, and right now on Spark, we're looking at the future of collaborating with machine learning systems and robots. My guest is Brian Christian, an author who researches the human implications of computer science. So just to return to machine learning, if machine learning is increasingly being used in the workplace, what do you think that might look like? Like, how will end users cooperate with an AI in practice, presumably after it's been trained?
I think it starts to take the form of something that looks like a dialogue. And we've seen this with ChatGPT, of course, that the original versions of GPT-3 and GPT-4 have a very specific structure, which is that they are built to autocomplete passages of text. And people who are very adept at working with them can find all sorts of creative ways to use that autocomplete ability to do various things, from machine translation to programming and so forth. But it is not the natural way that humans, certainly it's not the natural way that humans work with one another. It's like, okay, Nora, here's a text. Can you like complete this text? rather, it's a conversation. There are requests that are made. There are, you know, instructions given. And so I think that's been the real leap forward with ChatGPT, which is no more powerful than the underlying systems that it was based on, but is much more user-friendly, you might say, much more intuitive, because your interaction with it takes the form of a conversation.
But to use that example of generative AI like ChatGPT, is it also true that we have to become better at learning how to frame our requests to get the responses that we want?
It's certainly been the case throughout, you know, our relationship with computers that we have had to, in effect, speak to computers in their language. You know, initially that means learning how to actually write computer code, you know, go to 10, print X. More recently, I think about things like Google, where 15, 20 years of using Google has imprinted in all of our minds what some people call Googleese, or when we have a question, we immediately start to frame it in this sort of broken English of a query, mm-hmm. you know, like foot pain, aspirin, dose adult, you know, or whatever yeah. the thing might be. Ironically, Google increasingly prefers you to ask your question in natural language, but we've, you know, been trained through the 2000s to speak in this kind of broken keyword pattern. I think there's inevitably going to be a similar process that emerges with ChatGPT, where people just kind of start to intuit the best practices of how to get what they want from the system. But it does feel to me that there's an undeniable trajectory, if you look at the history of computer science, of progressing closer and closer to the system interacting with us on our terms, in our language, in our patterns, rather than the other way around. Mm. And so it's clear that we're on that trajectory still.
So to be a bit speculative about it, I mean, if things go right, what would an optimal working relationship look like?
From my perspective, an optimal working relationship with a computer system would look very similar and very recognizable to an optimal relationship between human coworkers. There would be a kind of, you know, shared language, shared idioms, perhaps even inside jokes where you've created this shared context and you can refer to things in a very kind of idiosyncratic and compressed way. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that makes human relationships work so well at their best is history and context. And so at the moment, today's most advanced AI systems can remember some number of tens of thousands of words of history. Ideally, you'd like them to remember 20 years of history. Mm-hmm. Any of us who have a relationship with a, you know, a spouse or a partner or best friend, you know, you can reference something that happened 20 years ago and have the other person immediately know what you're talking about. And so I think that's that really rich, high context relationship is something of the aspiration.
And where do you think there might continue to be tensions in a working relationship with machine learning systems or even with robots?
Something I think that's important to remember, certainly when I think about the phrase, the alignment problem, this is an expression that the computer science community has borrowed from economists. Economists in the 80s and 90s were writing about, you know, how do we create a value-aligned organization? How do we align the incentives of your subordinates with your goals as the manager or whatever it might be? And I think that's a very useful metaphor to keep in mind as we think about our relationship with machine learning systems, because there is that question of, even if you can perfectly understand one another, are the incentives aligned? Hmm. And I think that's a source of tension both in human relationships. You know, people have written about realtors, for example. Is your realtor really working for the best price for you, or are they just working for the, you know, the greatest deal flow for themselves, and they want to just sell your house and move on to the next client and get the next commission and so forth? Mm-hmm. And so that's a source of tension in human relationships. You know, this comes through in the workplace all the time, where, you know, individual incentives might diverge from team incentives, and so people end up kind of infighting within a corporation or something like that. I think that's going to end up being very significant when we think about our relationship with machine learning. And I think this is already the case. So for example, Spotify curates music that they think that you will like, but they also have responsibilities to artists. If artists' songs are not getting played enough, they might yank their license from Spotify, and Spotify doesn't want that. So they need to appease people on both sides. TikTok, for example, has this reputation for giving these very personalized recommendations to the users, but they also have to appeal to their advertisers. And if they're courting an advertiser, they might push that advertiser's content to more users than normal because they want to make it seem attractive. And so I think these questions of incentives, like is the business model aligned, that will end up being very important in the you know, medium to long term in terms of our relationship with AI. Mm. You know, an AI assistant might perfectly understand what we want, but still in some fundamental way, it's trying to help me as the user, but it also needs to serve the business model of the company that's providing this system to me.
Brian, thanks so much, as always, for your insights on this.
It's my pleasure, Nora. Thanks for having me.
Brian Christian is an author and researcher focused on the human implications of computer science. His most recent book on the subject is The Alignment Problem. You've been listening to Spark. The show is made by Michelle Parisi, Samarit Yohannes, McKenna Hadley-Burke, and me, Nora Young, and by Sally Augustine, Bill Burnett, and Brian Christian. Follow Spark on your favorite podcast app, and you can find us on social media where we are Spark CBC. I'm Nora Young. Talk to you soon.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.